So I've shared before about Kimberly's heart for those in the LGBTQ plus alphabet community, we'll call it. She, for some reason, God saw fit when she worked with Bob Evans to provide her with relationships with a number of those in that community, and then with Columbus State in the program that she was in, there were a handful of them, three or four. And so even at DACC when she was there. And for some reason, they've always been comfortable around her. And it's because that even though she's, and you all know Kimberly, or most of you do, she's just very black and white. She just speaks her mind. She can come across sometimes as being somewhat offensive because people don't like the straightforward boldness sometimes. You know, I've always shared this example that if you walked in and said, "Does this dress make me look fat?" If it made you look fat, she would say, "Of course." Instead of saying, "Well, you know, maybe a different color would be better on you, or a different cut, you know," and just be, that's just the way she is. It's right and wrong, black and white. And she can be that way with these folks. She can say, "Hey, I'm a Christian. I don't, you know, believe in your lifestyle." And for some reason, some of these folks have just said, "We're okay with that. We're cool." Because she's, well, in fact, we had one that came by the house. I had the opportunity to share the gospel with her and her boyfriend, sitting at the, kitchen table. And what was interesting is she said, "One of the things we like about Kimberly is she's just straight with us." She's like, "So many others just aren't. And we can tell." You know, so anyway, I bring all that up just to preface this next comment, that when Kimberly got ready to go down to the ARC last year for her internship, as she got a little closer, she began to express to me her concerns with going because, in her mind, I'm leaving these people behind. And some of them had come to church with her, had gone with her both to Grace and over to Delaware Bible Church, and some of them had talked with the pastor. She had a conversation with Pastor Zach at Grace one time about, is it okay? Because one of the people was somebody who identified as transgender. And she's like, "What do we do with this person if they come and they need to use the bathroom here?" And so she began to express to me her concern with, if I leave, who's going to be the salt and light? Who are they going to have to witness Christ to them? And so I told her, I said, "Well, don't worry about it. You know, God will take care of all of that, you know." Well, what's interesting is when she got down to the ARC, we did a lot of these video chats through Google Meet. And one day she chatted with me, and she was so excited because she's like, "You know, Dad, I get it now. One of the girls that she got to know at the ARC that lived in the housing with her pulled her aside one day and expressed to her that she was attracted to women, but she knew it was wrong, and she had struggled for so long with that. But she knew she could confide in Kimberly about her struggle." And so Kimberly said, "Look what God did. Look at where He put me." You know, she was so afraid that I couldn't be salt and light over here anymore, but now I can be salt and light here and help this girl who's struggling with this. And so I bring that up as an example today because the two parables that we see in this passage today have to do with salt and light and our role in this world in being salt and light. Now, depending on one's definition of what a parable is, we talked about this last week, not everybody agrees on what a parable is or how many parables there are. Somebody asked me last night, it was John, "How many are there?" And I said, anywhere between 30 and 75. You know, I counted up 65 myself. You know, so depending, not everybody considers these parables. Some have such a narrow definition of parable that it has to be a story with a plot and characters. Some say, "Oh no, it can be any figure of speech, and it's so broad that almost everything would qualify as a parable." So it's somewhere in between there. But I gave a definition that I think is an appropriate definition, which is essentially that a parable is a figure of speech or a story, could be either one, that's used by Jesus to teach a spiritual truth or illuminate a spiritual truth through the use of comparison. And those can be similes, metaphors, you name it. In fact, we're going to cover a parable from John where a lot of people say there's no parables in John, but yet you have the Good Shepherd and you have one more. And they would certainly qualify as parables. So I look at these and I believe that they are parables in part because there's a statement where one of the disciples asked at one point about parables that are very similar to this. So I'm going to refer to these as parables this morning. The way that we're going to approach this And this is kind of what I've been doing in my own study as I've been working through the parables, is we look at the context first. Now, I don't know if David and Dustin will follow the exact same pattern or not, but I'm going to be following the pattern as best I can to first talk about the context that we find the parable in. Because every parable, and we learned this last week, has a context. And oftentimes, when pastors and teachers teach on parables, they ignore the context. They just go right to the parable. And that's all they talk about is the parable. And then they assign some meaning to the parable. Oftentimes, way more meaning than what's actually found there. And you can't do that because Jesus used parables specifically to illuminate or to teach something. And so, we're going to look at the context first. What led Jesus to use this? Then we're going to look at the actual teaching. We're going to look at the parables that are used to illustrate. And then we're going to come up with a takeaway. So what do we do with all of this? So the first thing we're going to do is just we're going to look at the context this morning. So the context surrounding these two parables in Matthew 5 is the Sermon on the Mount. And more specifically, these two parables follow immediately on the heels of the Beatitudes, which are at the very beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus began his Sermon on the Mount with 8 Beatitudes. So that's really the context for what we're going to look at today with these parables. They take place very early in Jesus' ministry. In fact, these are the first two parables that are recorded in the Gospels. And if you remember, we talked last week that in the early part of Jesus' ministry, he didn't use parables as frequently as he did later. And when he did use them, they were very, very simple in the beginning. They would require that he didn't really have to explain them to a whole lot of people. He sometimes had to give some meaning, and we'll see that today. But they're examples that were taken from their own life. They generally would have been a little bit easier to understand. As he gets later in his ministry, he used them a lot more frequently, and he got much more complex with them and had to explain them. And the reason for that was, as we learned last week, the Jews had become so hard in their heart that they were refusing to listen. And so it was a form of judgment. I'll speak in a way that your ears can't hear and your eyes can't see. And if you really want to know what I'm talking about, you're going to have to struggle. You're going to have to listen. You're going to have to ask. And so we see today that these are very, very simple parables. For the first century Jew, they would not have really required a whole lot of interpretation to understand them, but we're not first century Jews. So we're going to have to explain them a little bit today, especially the first one. Now, I believe it's a bit unfortunate that the Sermon on the Mount is referred to as the Sermon on the Mount. And the reason for that is we picture, when we think of Sermon on the Mount, we think of Jesus standing up on the mountainside, you know, preaching to the masses, some giant crowd. But that's not what we've got. In fact, the Sermon on the Mount was actually a more intimate discussion with the disciples. Now, the crowds were there, but the crowds were on the peripheral. They were able to listen in and kind of hear what was going on, but that's not who Jesus was directing these words to. This was a very intimate discussion with his disciples. In fact, specifically and more closely with the 12, whom he had just selected prior to this. In fact, if you look at Matthew chapter 5, look at the first two verses. Matthew chapter 5, the first two verses, it says, when Jesus saw the crowds, what did he do? He went up on the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him. He opened his mouth and he began to teach them, his disciples. Now Luke actually also covers this. Now some think that Luke's recording of this was a totally separate event because there's some slight differences. But many, like me, believe that Luke was also recording the exact same event. And that's why there's some similarities between the two. But if you turn to Luke chapter 6 with me, we see this a little more starkly here. Luke chapter 6, we're going to go to verse 12. It was at this time that when he went off to the mountain to pray, and he spent the whole night in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples to him, and he chose 12 of them, whom he also named as apostles. Simon, whom he called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, and James, and John, and Philip, and Bartholomew, and Matthew, and Thomas, James, the son of Alphaeus, and Simon, who was called the Zealot. Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. Jesus came down with them and stood on a level place, and there was a large crowd of his disciples, a great throng of people from all Judea and Jerusalem and the coastal region of Tyre and Sidon, who had come to hear him and to be healed of their diseases, and those who were troubled with unclean spirits were being cured. And all the people were trying to touch him, for power was coming out of him and healing all of them. Now look at this. And turning his gaze toward his disciples, he began to say. So the crowds are definitely there. And it's a fairly significant crowd because it includes a lot of people who had considered themselves disciples, which is just a word for followers. But it also included just a throng of people from Judea and Samaria that had come. So what you might imagine is this large crowd of people, those who are consider themselves actually followers, who are just not just a crowd of people that are interested, who's this? We don't hear what he says, but those who had liked what they heard, had considered themselves disciples. So you think there's this large crowd, and then there's this smaller, but still fairly large crowd of disciples, and then you have the 12. And the 12 are sitting there right with them. And the text even tells us that Jesus sat down with them. This is an intimate conversation with the disciples. This is not some big sermon on the side of a mountain preaching out to the people. This is a discussion that Jesus is having specifically with his disciples. And there's a specific purpose for it. We'll see that in a minute. R.T. France wrote a commentary on the book of Matthew. And he actually renames this Sermon on the Mount as the Discourse on Discipleship. The Discourse on Discipleship, because what this was really about was Jesus was telling the disciples, especially the 12, what he expected of them as disciples. This is boot camp. Wright says it this way, the focus of these chapters is not the wider proclamation of the good news of the kingdom, but the instruction of those who had already responded to the proclamation and now need to learn that life in the kingdom of heaven and what it's really about. The teaching will frequently describe them as a special group who stand over against and are indeed persecuted by people in general. They are those who have entered into a new relationship with their Father in heaven and who in consequence are called to a radically new lifestyle, in conscious distinction from the norms of the rest of society. That's what Jesus is calling them to. These Beatitudes we're going to look at, they were a high bar. And Jesus was saying, you need to stand above culture, above society. You're going to be different than culture and society. So he was setting a high bar. The standards that Jesus set for his disciples was nothing short of perfection here. When we see these, it's like being like God himself. He didn't intend for them, however, these Beatitudes to be this strict religious do's and don'ts. He wasn't saying, do these things and you'll be righteous and perfect and holy, because nobody could do the things that Jesus was going to describe all on their own. What it was going to require was Christ in them through the power of the Holy Spirit living these things out. This bar that Jesus is going to set for them with these Beatitudes was something they were to look to, something they were aspire to desire to be like, because they were qualities and traits of God. But again, it wasn't something Jesus was telling them, this is now the standard, you've got to do this to please me. It was, this is what I expect of you as my disciples. And the only way that disciples were going to be able to do it was abiding in Christ. And that is played out in the rest of the Gospels. Jesus made that absolutely clear. So when we read through these, what we need to see is Jesus is telling us as disciples, this is the expectation. This is what you should look like. This is what you should be like. This is what you should strive for. But he wasn't giving us a list of do's and don'ts that would make us righteous or holy. We are only made righteous and holy by our relationship with Jesus Christ, him living inside of us. And we are only capable of these things because the Spirit lives inside of us. And so that's what we're going to see with this. And part of the reason that I describe it this way is because a little bit later in this passage, Jesus tells them their righteousness has to exceed even that of the most religious people in their culture and society, the religious leaders. He goes on a little bit later and says, be perfect. So this is a high standard that Jesus is going to set. There are high expectations for his disciples. They are supposed to stand out from culture and society. So that's going to be the context when he gets to the parables. So let's look at this teaching. Let's look at these Beatitudes. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the Beatitudes, only because I want to get into the parables. But one thing I did do was, you can get these notes, you can download them right on the website, okay? I have about 2 pages in the back, or a page and a half, that goes through each one of the Beatitudes and simply gives some highlights as to what does it mean to be pure in heart. So you can do that. go through and just kind of look at that, and that'll help you with some of the meat of the Beatitudes. But if I spend time doing all that this morning, we'd be here for an hour and a half, and I know an hour is long enough. So, you can find that on there. I'll make some comments here. But for the most part, we're going to read through the Beatitudes with some minimal comments, just to give us an idea. Many of them are somewhat self-explanatory. So, what did Jesus expect of his disciples? It's found in the Beatitudes and the rest of the sermon, but the Beatitudes are how he begins it. They're called Beatitudes. It comes from the Latin term, because each one of the pronouncements Jesus makes begins with what the Greek word is the blessing, markios, or makarios, I'm sorry. Now, some look at these and they like to translate that word blessed as happy because that's one of the possible meanings. But that's not what Jesus intends here. There's another meaning of the word blessed. It includes happiness, but it generally reflects a state of spiritual well-being, spiritual prosperity, and spiritual contentment. So it's more of a state of contentment spiritually. But it can include the idea of happy. But if we translate this simply here as happy are these people, that misses the point completely, because that's not what Jesus is saying. Jesus doesn't promise us just a happy life. He promises us a life filled with joy. But joy and happiness are not always exactly the same, because you can have joy without happiness. There are times that we will be happy. But what Jesus is promising here when he uses this word blessed, again where we find our word Beatitudes, is that it refers again to this state of spiritual well-being and contentment. Spiritually, you are well. You are blessed spiritually. So the Beatitudes, as you look at them here, describe the character trait, and then they're going to describe the rewards of that character trait. And so each one of these Beatitudes has two parts to it. The first part is the blessing, the trait, what the disciple is to be like. And then the second half of the Beatitude is the blessings that come from that, the rewards from that. So, there are a total of 8 of them here. We don't have enough time to go through, you know, a deep dive into each one of them. But I want you to see this as I read through them. The first thing is that they begin with a godly quality or trait that Jesus expects of his disciples. That is then followed by this reward. It's generally something God gives, or it's a natural outcome of that godly trait. And then the last thing I want us to remember is that these aren't just musings of Jesus. You know, it's a good thing if you're this, or a good thing if you're that. These are expectations. In other words, he's saying, this is what you need to be like as a disciple. So let's just go ahead and read through these Beatitudes. We're in chapter 5, starting in verse 3. He says, blessed are the poor in spirit. That means to sort of be humble. It doesn't literally mean poor, but humble in spirit, not arrogant or proud. For theirs, he says, is the kingdom of heaven. That's who will be in the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn. And the idea there is not just the people who mourn occasionally, but who have a rough life, who on a regular basis, their life is one of difficulty and challenges. I think of our friend Aaron, who just has a hard life with the Lyme disease. And there's a lot of mourning in that. And so he says, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. He goes on and says, blessed are the gentle. That's the word for meek. That's the word used to describe Jesus. It's those who don't seek their own revenge, for they shall inherit the earth. Verse 6, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Those who desire godliness. They want to be godly. They want to be like Christ. They want to be like our Heavenly Father. He says, blessed are those, for they shall be satisfied or satiated. They'll be filled up. Remember we talked about Abraham, who was satisfied with his life? That's what's described here. Verse 7, blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Remember God, or Jesus said, if you forgive others, the Lord will forgive you. There's that element of mutual mercy and forgiveness that's given. And so just like He is merciful, we are to be merciful as well, and we receive mercy. Verse 8, blessed are the pure in heart. That word for pure there is a ceremonial thing. It means to not be defiled, to have a good heart, for they shall see God. Verse 9, blessed are the peacemakers, those who make peace, those who desire peace. We've seen this before where we're told by Paul, as long as it is up to us, as much as it is possible for us to be at peace, not just with fellow believers, but with all people, we should strive for that. Because that's in the heart of a disciple. is to desire peace. One of the concerns I have today with what's happening in the evangelical church is that we've made so many of those that are unlike us our enemies. We hate the LGBT community now. We hate those liberal politicians. We hate. You know, God's not thrilled with what happens in the LGBT community. He despises that. But you know, He doesn't call us to be at war with them. We're to be trying to win them to Christ. But there is so much in our churches today where we've been so riled up that we are almost like we like the fight. But we should desire to be at peace as much as it's possible for us. I love when Paul says that he wants the only offense to be the offense of the gospel. He doesn't want to be offender. He didn't want to be offensive himself. I know Christians who are offensive. Blessed are the peacemakers. That doesn't mean we compromise. We still hold tight to the truth. We're like a Kimberly. You know what? I'm not going to support your lifestyle, but I'm going to love you. I'll be your friend. I'll tell you about Jesus. I'll go on walks with you to talk to you. I'm not going to hate you. I'm not going to be your enemy, but I'll be truthful. So being a peacemaker does not mean compromise. For they, it says, shall be called the sons of God. How about verse 10? Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who are persecuted, because theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Verse 11, blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you and because of me. Some people would add that as a ninth beatitude. I think it's part of the previous one. That's why I said there's only eight. But we're blessed when we're persecuted and they say all kinds of false things against us. He says, verse 12, rejoice and be glad, for your reward is in heaven is great. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. So that's the teaching that Jesus gave. He set the bar extremely high for His disciples. And again, we have to see them that way. We have to see them as a high bar, an expectation. Again, it's not just Jesus musing. Hey, here's some things you might be interested in. You know, if you're a good disciple, if you do these things, yeah, you'll be blessed. You know, that's cool. We're kosher. No, He's just pulled these 12 disciples aside and He's saying, this is what it means to be a disciple of mine. That's why He's not preaching it to the masses. He's not even really preaching it to those who are saying, well, were your disciples Jesus? Many of those people who said they were His disciples, we find later out, says they all left. They walked away. That's why He's saying it to these 12. He specifically pulled them aside. He says, you are my disciples, you are my apostles, and this is what I expect of you. This is what it means to be a disciple, and you need to be serious about being a disciple. And hearing these things, some of them probably made them squirm a little bit. Wow, really? This is a high bar. Do I really want to do this? One of them clearly didn't. Judas. Now, this is where Jesus now introduces the parables. It's on the tail of this discussion, this teaching, this expectation. This is what it means to be a high bar. And if we don't see that, we're going to misinterpret these two parables. So here's the two parables. The first one is what I refer to as the parable of the salt. Jesus uses these parables now to illuminate what He just taught. And that's the key. How does this parable of light fit in with what He just taught them? The parable of the salt, look at verse 13. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. That's a parable. It's real simple. Part of understanding this is understanding how salt was used in the ancient Near East. There's a whole lot of variety of uses. It was used as a commodity when trading. You know the phrase, he's not worth his salt? That's where it comes from. They would use salt as a bartering item, like money. In fact, you could purchase slaves with salt. So it was a commodity used to trade. Salt was also used in medicine. It was used to prevent decay, to clean wounds, to reduce swelling. I'm not sure that if I had suffered a flesh wound that I would like to rub salt in it. We all know how that feels, but that's what they would do. Because it would cleanse, it would heal, it would reduce swelling. It was also used in religious ceremonies to purify objects and people. It was even used in legal contracts. When they would sign these contracts or make covenants, oftentimes they would serve a meal and they would cover it with salt as part of that contract. I don't know where that came from or why, but that's what they did. It was also used to flavor food. We know that. We do that here. It was used to preserve food. You could salt food. Think about it. They didn't have refrigeration back then like we do, so they would salt their food to preserve the meat. Another use was fertilizer. It was used to fertilize things. Now, it's often suggested that what Jesus has in mind here, they immediately jump to, oh, Jesus is talking about being the flavor of the world and we are here to preserve the world. They immediately jump to that conclusion, which I believe is the wrong conclusion. Was Jesus saying, you need to be salty. You need to taste good for the world. You're here to preserve the world. And that's why God has you here. That's oftentimes what is preached. That is probably the most common approach to this parable. I don't believe that's what Jesus intended. I believe that what Jesus is using salt for here is a metaphor for the fertilizer example. That what he's basically saying is, you are the fertilizer. Now, why would I say that? First off, he specifically refers to them as the salt of the earth. Did you catch that? Notice he says back in verse 13, you are the salt of the earth. If Jesus was talking about flavoring or preserving food, we would expect him probably, now again, it's an argument from silence to some degree, but we would expect him to maybe use something like, you are the salt of food. You are the flavoring for food. Not, you're the salt of the earth. Now that's going to be key here in a moment. He uses the same illustration in Luke 14. And he does something interesting there. So turn to Luke chapter 14. Now this isn't the same situation, but it is the same illustration. Luke chapter 14. Look at verses 33 through 35. Luke 14. Jump down to verse 33. And notice it's a very similar context. So then, none of you can be my disciple who does not give up all of his own possessions, meaning you better value me more than anything you own, or you can't be my disciple, who does not give up all his possessions. Therefore, salt is good, meaning you as a disciple, you're salt. Salt is good, but if even salt has become tasteless, and we'll cover that in a minute here, with what will it become seasoned? Now look at verse 35, and this is the key. It is useless either for what? The soil, or for the manure pile. These are fertilizers. So he just basically said, salt's good, unless it loses, and he says taste here, but actually, I'll explain that in a minute. He says, if it's no longer salt, it's no good for the soil, not even for the manure pile, which is what they would mix it with to use it as fertilizer. So Jesus himself is telling them, he's using the example of salt here, and it's a reference to fertilizer, not to food. Now you might be asking, well then why does he say if it becomes tasteless? Well, that word is not the word for tasteless. It's the word for meaningless. It's a word that's translated foolishness in other places. The only time it is ever translated as tasteless is when it's used with the example of salt. It's kind of interesting. So he really doesn't say, well, if it becomes tasteless, he's really referring to it no longer being salty. In fact, a little bit later in the Gospels, Jesus uses a word that actually says when salt becomes unsalty. And he uses the Greek word for unsalty. And he says, how can it become salty again? What Jesus is doing here is he's basically saying the salt becomes meaningless. It's no longer salty. And when it is no longer salty, you can't make it salty again. You can't re-salt it. Now the reason that makes sense in their culture, not so much ours, if I reach in my cupboard at home and I take down some salt, it's pure sodium chloride. It's just pure salt. It can't become unsalty. In their day, salt wasn't pure. It was mixed with other chemicals because that's the way they would take it from the Dead Sea. It was mixed with other chemicals. And what would happen is it would sit out in the sun or it would get mixed with water or other things. The salt, the sodium chloride, would leach out and what would be left were the other chemicals. It still would look like salt, but it wasn't salt. And so Jesus is using a real-life example. If all the salt leaches out of what we call salt, it's no longer salt. You can't remake it salty. It's just a bunch of other chemicals taken out of the Dead Sea or the rock cliffs. And so he's really not saying, well, if the salt doesn't taste like salt anymore, it's no good and you can't season food with it. He's saying, if what we call salt loses that sodium chloride, what makes it salt, you can't make it salt again. And it's no longer good. In fact, look back at chapter 5. He says, it's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. The problem was, and this is really what Jesus is getting at, is he's saying salt is a fertilizer. They would have understood that. Like I said, elsewhere he makes it really clear when he's talking in Luke. He's talking about fertilizer. He's like, you all know that if this salt loses that salty chemical nature to it, and it's no longer salt, it's no good to be thrown into the ground to become good for the soil. It's not even good enough to be thrown on the manure pile and mixed with another fertilizer. It's worthless. It's totally worthless. It's no good anymore. That's the example he's using with the disciples. And what did he say? You are that salt. If you lose what it means to be a disciple, I just gave you the 8 Beatitudes to tell you what it looks like to be a disciple. And if you don't look like that, you're just like that fertilizer, that salt that's no good. It's no fertilizer anymore. It's good for nothing. So he uses this example of fertilizer. You are the salt, the fertilizer of the earth. And you need to stay salty. Second parable is the parable of light. That's in verses 14, 15, and 16. He says, you are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand. And it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. In John chapter 12, verse 36, Jesus said, while you have the light, which is a reference to himself, believe in the light so that you may become sons of light. We have Jesus as disciples. His light should shine through us. When people look at us, they should see Christ. Now that's a tall order to fill, isn't it? That's the purpose of the Beatitudes. Look like Christ, be like Christ, so that when others see you, they see Christ. You've heard that phrase. I don't know if it comes from a song or somewhere else. Isn't it maybe an 80s song, praise and worship song? You're the only Jesus some will ever see. That's the reality of it here. So he says, you're the light of the world. There is no other light in this world. We are it. At least until Jesus returns. He begins by declaring that. Notice he gives this example of a city set on a hill and says it can't be hidden. The picture there is in part because at night, what happens with that city? You can still see the city, can't you? Why? The lights. Amy and I went to see the Northern Lights when they were, you could see them here in town. What a neat thing that was. But as we're driving north, we're trying to get away from Marion because even Marion, as small as it is and as far away as it is, you could see the light. You knew where Marion was. Because they didn't turn out every single light in Marion. It would have been nice if they had, for our sake. You know, we're up in Delaware, which is what, maybe, well, I'll say 12 miles from 270. You go out on the 23 and you look south, what can you see? The lights. So when a city in their day sat on a hill and it became dark, you could still see the city because that's what light does. He gave another example when someone lights a lamp. He says, they put it on a lampstand. Why? A lampstand is elevated. It's part of it. You don't put it on the floor, but you put it on a lampstand. You also don't take and cover it with a basket. Why? What's the purpose of a lamp? What's the purpose of a light? It's to light up the room so you can see. Amy and I walk into a room, I turn on a light. Amy walks in, she turns the light off. She asked me last night, she made a question. She goes, why'd you turn the light on? I said, because I'm in the kitchen, I want to see. And she's like, that's the wrong light. So she went and she turned on the other light, which didn't help me with where I was standing. I walk into a room, I turn on a light. She walks into a room, she turns off the light. It hurts her eye. You know, she's done that with me here, where it's like, turn those down, it's too bright up front, right? But the reality of it is, even with that, we still both use light. Okay? Why? That's the purpose of light. And he says, you are the light of the world. He goes on, let your light, and I would render this, therefore, let your light shine before men. In such a way that they may see your good works. So how do we reflect this light of Christ? Somebody want to help me out? How do we reflect this light? Through our what? Through our good works. Through our good works. What we do, how we behave, what we say. The Beatitudes. He had just got done telling them, these are the traits and the works. This is how you reflect the light. And he says, let them see your good works. I love the phrase, live out loud. Did you ever know these Christians? Maybe it's somebody you've never seen before, you've never met them before. They walk into a room or they walk in somewhere and you just immediately know, yeah, that's got to be a believer. That's got to be a believer. And then maybe you have somebody you've known for a decade and you're hanging out and you're chit-chatting. Maybe you don't know them real well, but they're an acquaintance. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, you're a Christian. Okay, that's shocking because they're moral and they're good. So maybe it's not shocking, but it's sort of like, okay. But it didn't really just the moment you met them stand right out and go, wow, that's a godly person. That they may see your good works. And what's the purpose of that? Jesus tells us right there, so that they might glorify your Father who is in heaven. Now we know that what glorifies our Father in heaven is salvation. I believe that's what he's got in mind here. Let your light shine so that it might ultimately lead to people coming to know Jesus Christ. So again, when we look back at the context, what we see here is Jesus pulls his disciples aside and he essentially says, this is what it means to be my disciple. I know it's a tall order. I'm asking you to be more righteous than the most righteous in society, those Pharisees and those Sadducees and those scribes. And for them, they would have gone, oh, that's a tall order. They're so righteous. Look at them. They walk around in their robes and they have all their, you know, rules and regulations and they're so righteous. And he's like, your righteousness needs to exceed even that of them. That's what he says later in the chapter. And then he even says, I need you to be perfect. Oh man, we can't be perfect. But again, as we understand the gospel, he tells us, yeah, but your perfection is going to come through your relationship with me. So I'm not asking you to be perfect on your own. I'm not asking you to be righteous on your own. I will do that through you because I will live in you. My righteousness will be your righteousness. My perfection will be your perfection. But that doesn't let you off the hook. You don't get to just come into church on a Sunday morning and sit down and say, hey, I'm a Christian, and go out into the world the rest of the week and not look like me. Jesus doesn't permit that. So he starts with the Beatitudes, the high bar. This is what I expect. And the reason then he gives these two parables is he says, I need you to be the fertilizer that leads people to Christ. I need you to be the light that leads people to Christ. And you can't do that if you're not this kind of disciple. You know, I don't know why the American church is dying today. You want to know why the numbers continue to shrink? We've not placed enough emphasis on being like Jesus. We've placed so much more emphasis on Jesus being our genie in a bottle that we just rub it and he gives us all the things we need, right? We've become so much like the world that we no longer are fertilizer and we are no longer light. We look just like the world. And you know what? In many respects, that's what the church did 25, 30 years ago. They said, hey, if we look more like the world, we'll attract more people. We got to get hip and cool just like the rest of the world so we can attract more people. And Jesus is saying, no, you need to stand out. You need to be like me. That's where these two parables get their meaning. We can't be salt. We can't be light unless what we are like is what we see in the Beatitudes. Can you see how important the context is now? Because maybe before this, when you thought of you're the salt of the earth, maybe it was like, yeah, we're the seasoning, we're the flavoring. No, you're the fertilizer. God uses us to grow His church, which is remarkable about that. And this is our takeaway in this. The idea of us being the fertilizer, have you ever thought about this? The church is really, in the Gospels, referred to, in some respects, kind of like a plant. It grows. Jesus even refers to the kingdom of God growing and how it grows. Remember the parable of the wheat and the tares? It grows a certain way. Ever think about this? That God gathering disciples, people getting saved, is referred to as a harvest. Jesus said, pray that God might send out people to harvest. Even in the book of Revelation, when we get to the end times, and it talks about that final harvest, reaping. It's farming language. And here Jesus does that with the salt. And so that's what God uses us for. We're part of this agricultural example. But in order to be that salt, in order to be that light, we actually have to be the kind of disciples that Jesus asks us and demands of us to be. It's not shocking that in the parable of the sheep and the goats, that the goats all say, "Hey, look at us. We did all these wonderful, awesome things in your name." And Jesus said, "I didn't know you." There are going to be a lot of people who wear that label Christian, and when they stand before Jesus, they're going to realize, oops, we weren't like Jesus. So again, that's where these parables get their meaning. So I have two questions for us, and I intend this to be questions for us, not you. It includes me. I think there's two questions we ought to ask. And the first question we ought to ask ourselves is whether or not we are truly being salt and light to this world. When you look at these Beatitudes, are these things you look at and go, "Yeah, that's, I'm not there yet, but that's what I want. I want to be like this because Jesus wants me to be like this. And I can't do it on my own, but He's promised me the Holy Spirit and He can do it through me. So yes, I can strive for these things. I can be transformed by these things." So if we ask that question, am I being salt and light? It has to come back to, do I really look like this? And if the answer to that question is, you know, I don't think I'm being salt and light because I don't strive for these things. I don't want these things in my own life. Or maybe I want them, but I'm not going to work at them. I'm not going to try all that hard. You know, I'm only going to be a peacemaker for those who are peaceful towards me. And these people that persecute me, oh, I'm going to let them have it. If that's the attitude, then we're not salt and light. So the first question is, am I the salt and light that Jesus wants me to be? And if the answer to that question is no, I think the second question we need to ask ourselves is, do we really take our roles as disciples seriously? Because that's the context here. If you could summarize all of this up, Jesus is sort of looking at them saying, I need you to take your role as disciples seriously. Because you're the salt. You're the light in my absence. So until He returns, we're it. We're the salt. We're the light. That's why they call us Christians. Mini Jesuses. Mini Christians. We are to reflect Him. So, are we being the salt and light that we need to be? And if not, are we really taking our role as disciples seriously?